children's church this morning, so. But we do have busy bags, so if you need some busy bags, we have some of those as well. 7.8 billion people live on the planet, and 7.4 of them live someplace else. 0.4 billion live here. What are the odds that you could have been born in one of the best countries in the history of the world?
Amen.
Right? That's a blessing.
Yes, it is.
And we are right, and it is good to thank God for the blessings that we've been given by being born here. And we share those blessings. So they are not just ours to enjoy, but ours to share as well. So I think people get confused about that a little bit from both sides. So thank you, Jeff, for singing this morning. In search of certainty in an age of uncertainty. And so I'm going to do part two as it has to do with the idea of being certain about truth. That there can be a certainty that there is truth. And that is important for us all. Because without truth, uncertainty can lead to paralyzing doubt. What can be believed? Whom to trust? How to have faith? And raises the question if there can be hope. So last week I talked about what I would refer to as a light presuppositional argument for truth and God as truth, and for the Bible as a source of our truth. So in other words, if you're going to have a discussion with me or someone's going to have a discussion with you, then we would begin with the idea that biblical truth is truth. That can't be negotiated. We're not going to offer any hypotheticals. This is God's truth. So it's what it is. And if you can't meet me there, then we may not be able to have certain parts of that conversation. So I want to take you to a text at 1 Corinthians 1, verses 18 through 25. So if you have your Bibles, you can turn to that, 1 Corinthians 1, verses 18 through 25. And the Apostle Paul is writing to the Christians in Corinth. Of all the cities in the New Testament and during the New Testament era, the city of Corinth probably is most like ours. I mean, all of them were like Corinth to a certain degree, but Corinth was one of those cities that was just incredibly diverse. In the Temple of Diana, at one time, they employed 20,000 prostitutes, males and females. 20,000 prostitutes in the city of Corinth at one time. So it was an incredibly immoral city. It was a significant city. The Pan-Hellenistic Games, which were run in the city of Corinth, were second only in their significance to the games that were run in Athens, Greece. So it was a city that occupied a prominent place in the Mediterranean basin. But with that, it had many, many issues. And the church in Corinth struggled with all of that stuff that was in Corinth infiltrating their particular church. Corinth was a Greek city, and so it had a significant Greek influence in it and Greek thought. So Paul, when he was writing to Corinth, was writing to them because there was a lot of corrections that needed to take place. And so he begins in pretty much in this chapter, beginning with verse 18, by saying, "For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing. But to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. So the Apostle Paul was going after to the elites in Corinth, the people who were well educated, the aristocracy, those who ran the government, who educated the people, people who thought they were very wise and informed and well educated. Paul quotes and says, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. These people think that they are smart, but they are not. And the discernment of the discerning, I will thwart, I will frustrate, I will stop. And so the people who thought that they knew something in relationship to God knew nothing, according to Paul. So he goes on to say in verse 20, Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? So the word wise here comes from the Greek word sophos, a person who is skilled, an expert, a person considered to be wise, skilled in letters, cultivated and learned. Where are these people? Where is the sophist? Paul was saying. And where is the scribe? That word scribe comes from the word grammatus. He is the town clerk, a public servant, a secretary or recorder, a person who gathers information and knowledge. In the Bible, the scribe was a man who was learned in the Mosaic law and in the sacred writings. He was an interpreter, a teacher. He was the one who examined the more difficult and subtle questions of the law. Where is the most learned of the scribes? Where is that person? He says. And then he goes on to say, where is the debater of this age? So that person in the Greek is a pseudzeteses, a disputer, a learned person who argues, a sophist himself. And in today's parlance, we would consider them to be a pundit. Where is the pundit of this age? Your TVs are full of pundits every day and every night. We just see pundit after pundit who claims to know something. Verse 21, for since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God. So he's saying, look, the world says we're smart, we're wise, we're educated, but you don't know God. And so if you don't know the most important thing, then just how smart are you? How wise are you? Paul is saying. For since in the wisdom of God the world did not know God, through wisdom it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. So the world believes that what Paul had to say was folly. It was foolishness. It was absurd. And yet it was through that message of absurdity that Paul and the apostles spoke that the world came to know Jesus Christ. It wasn't through the wisdom of the Greeks or through the knowledge of the scribes. It was through the message of Jesus Christ that those people at that time considered to be folly. Does this sound familiar to you? Does the world ever really change? We have in our culture today the elites who think they know something, that they are wise, informed, and learned. And the message that you and I responded to, the person that you and I follow and try to pattern our lives after, that's foolishness according to the world. And yet, Paul's message to them would be the same today as it was then. How in your wisdom and in your knowledge, in your sophistry, in your punditry, how and in what way does it ever lead people to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ? And in that saving knowledge, They begin to pattern themselves after Christ, grow in his knowledge, work out their salvation through fear and trembling, so that they could enter into eternity and be in the presence of God forever and ever. How in your wisdom, in your knowledge, in your education, in your sophistry, how does that ever help people in that way? It doesn't. Verse 22, for the Jews demanded signs, the Greeks seek wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and folly to the Gentiles. Understand this, that for most of the world and for most people in this culture, what you believe, what you trust in is foolishness. It is folly. In their minds, you surrender too much. You surrender your autonomy, your ability to live your own life, to do what you want to do. And the cost is too great. Verse 24. But to those who called both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, not that God is foolish in any way, but seemingly from our perspective, foolish. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. So I spent last Sunday, and I'm spending this Sunday, talking about this idea of truth and the certainty of truth, the importance of truth. And I spent some time last week giving you a bit of a background. And part of my frustration is it's a holiday weekend. Maybe I should have spoken on something that's more... because we're missing a lot of people because of vacations and family travel and things like that. And so I hope that those who are listening really listen. And I'm hoping that other people tune in. Because I'm talking to you today about something that... That is of paramount importance. I'm talking to you today about what we would call macro truth, the big truth, the universal, the absolutes as it relates to truth. And I'm going to talk to you about micro truth, the everyday truths that we live out, that we think to be true and or are true. Every week, I spend a significant amount of time online reading, researching, following the culture, sometimes 2 to 4 hours a day. And I engage a fair number of people. I want you to do something. I want you to imagine that you are not a citizen of the United States. I want you to imagine that you're from another country entirely, a country that's somewhat removed from the rest of the world, and you've immigrated to the United States, and you're kind of curious. You want to know what the nature of this country really is like. You want to know what they believe. You're fascinated. You've heard so many things, and so you want to plug into their politics. You want to plug into their education. You want to plug into their pop culture. You want to plug into their educational system. You want to see what this country really believes. What are the truths that would be conveyed to you today? What does this country value? What is their ideology? I want you to be that person. So if you were to come to this country, these are the things. And I'm just scratching the surface. And there are a number of them. And I want to tell you, every day, I engage people on at least half a dozen of these topics. Every day. This is the truths that you would hear if you were visiting this country. These are paramount. They have saturated the culture. Now think about that as a new citizen. And then if you can, think about that for most of you when you were growing up. Think about these statements. God does not exist. All religions are essentially the same. Their basic message is to love your neighbors and do unto others as you would have them do unto you. All religions are essentially the same. This is essentially what all religions believe, including the Christian religion. This is the essence of their belief. No religion and their gods is any better or worse, any more true or false than any other religion. God does not judge or punish because God is love. All people go to heaven. Satan and hell are myths. They do not exist. Every day, every week, every month I encounter people who in the highest levels of this country are saying these things in every corner. The Bible is a collection of made up and evolving myths written to explain things that were not understood in the world before reason, science, and education. The Bible is a collection of made-up and evolving myths. It was because of Jesus' remarkable life and teachings as a human being that initially made him legendary, but that over time, his followers eventually raised him up to the status of God. You're a new citizen. You're getting to feel the culture. This is what you're hearing. The most important thing to understand about Jesus' life and work is the example he provided for us regarding the poor, oppressed, homeless, and minorities. The most important thing about Jesus' life and work. Jesus was crucified on the cross not as a substitutionary sacrifice for humankind's sins, but as a martyr on behalf of the poor, the oppressed, powerless, because the powerful, wealthy, and elite hated his message. They crucified him. There is no absolute truth nor universal laws that apply to all people at all times and in all places. There is no absolute truth nor universal laws. The only truth in this world is a relative truth that applies only to the person and not to anyone else. What is true for me is true. What is true for you is true. I can't judge your truth. You can't judge my truth. So I mentioned last week about the French continental philosophers, and I'm just going to give you a couple quotes, a quote each from one of them that kind of summarizes what they teach. But I just want you to understand that these three men that I'm quoting have absolutely dominated, overwhelmed, overcome the entire higher educational system in our country. Dominated. I'm of the opinion that you ought to take some of those places of higher education and burn them to the ground. What they are saying is so destructive and so toxic. These are some of the things they are saying. Meaning, example, words is never fixed or static, but always evolving. And this is the phrase, there is no meaning outside the text. So whatever you read, you do not read as the author intended you to get meaning from it. You read what they wrote and you get your own meaning from it. So I can read this Bible and what God intended for me to understand in this Bible doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. I read this Bible to get my own meaning. And however it speaks to me, that is what is true for me. And you cannot sit and judge me, judgment of me in that. Now, having been a former professor, right? I can't imagine a professor standing in front of a group of students and teaching this crap, right? And saying, I just want you to read literature and get your own meaning. When you write your report, I don't want to hear anything about what the author intended. Just write what it means to you. And then I would say as a student, professor, you know the syllabus that you wrote? Am I allowed to derive my own meaning from your syllabus? So if it says read chapter 16 through 18 and that I have a paper to write and there will be a test on Thursday, I can put my own meaning in that syllabus and that doesn't exist? I mean, the absurdity of a professor arguing with students that there is no meaning outside of the text, and yet he or she hands them a syllabus to follow for the semester that they have to follow to successfully get through the class and get a grade. There are no meta-narratives. Any claim to a surpassing and overarching meta-narrative is absurd. There are no big stories by which countries or people should live their lives. The meta-narrative of Christianity, the meta-narrative of how the United States came into being, it's absurd. It is a rejection. So in this is by Jean-Francois Lyotard, it is a rejection of meta-narratives that try to legitimate themselves, often using universal reason. Meta-narratives do not exist. So if you buy into the Judeo-Christian worldview, the biblical Judeo-Christian worldview, it's absurd. Any big story doesn't exist. Knowledge is only about power, and power is only about knowledge. This is by Michel Foucault. According to Foucault's understanding, power is based on knowledge and makes use of knowledge. On the other hand, power reproduces knowledge by shaping it in accordance with its anonymous intention. So you've heard it said that the ones who write the history are the ones who win the wars. That's the spirit of this. Because they exercised power and they won the war, then they went back and rewrote history according to how they wanted to, and they used that knowledge to legitimize themselves. That's in almost every history class in higher education. This way of thinking has utterly saturated higher education. Christians are inherently arrogant, hateful, intolerant, and bigoted. And boy, when I get on those comment sections on social media or when I go to major sites, you cannot believe the hate aimed at Christians. I can debate respectfully, nicely, and I'm still called hateful, and they can say the worst possible things that could be said toward a person, and they justify that because they're they're more about kindness and truth and grace than I am. I mean, stunning. The United States Constitution was written by men as a tool to facilitate their greed, oppression, racism, and misogyny. I have a couple of degrees in social science, so I always find this one to be interesting. The social research is conclusive. If you identify and or vote conservative, it necessarily means that you are less educated. You have lower natural intelligence, and you are not as evolved genetically. Study after study by sociologists have determined this to be true. And when you engage some of those elites online, this is exactly where they're coming from. That's very patronizing. The social research is conclusive. For those who are progressive, leftists, they are more and better educated, more naturally intelligent, and more evolved genetically. This is their truth. This is what they believe. This is what you would hear if you were coming to this nation for the first time. The idea that one's sex biologically necessarily means their gender must correspond is a social and cultural construct. So for most of us, if you were born with a certain kind of equipment, right, then that equipment corresponded with you being considered to be male or female. But today, you can be born with a certain kind of equipment, but be identified with as another gender with the opposite equipment. And this, again, in higher education, this is sacrosanct. You don't dare question this in higher education. If you're a professor, you will lose your job. If you're an administrator, you will lose your job. If you're a student, you will be forced to go to sensitivity classes. A person cannot choose their sexual identity. They are genetically predisposed to be gay, lesbian, bisexual, pansexual, transgender, and fetophile and pedophile. Pedophile and fetophile. Do you know the difference between a pedophile and a fetophile, by the way? A pedophile is a person who is attracted to children, younger children. A fetophile is a person who is attracted to a prepubescent child. And by the way, I think it's Derrida, the guy that I mentioned, one of the postmodern philosophers from France, argues for fetophilia and pedophilia, argues for it. There are more than two genders and probably more than 80 genders. And who can keep track? And I'm telling you, again, in higher education especially, or in certain areas of pop culture, if you misapply the gender, like if you think somebody is transgender but they're really pansexual, they will rip into you. How could you not possibly know what it is? Pansexual means that you are absolutely open to everything. Everything. It is perfectly rational to believe a person can wake up one day and gender identify as a male and the next morning wake up and be a female. So you have psychiatrists and psychologists who will make this argument. People with master's degrees and doctoral degrees, PhDs, people who went to school for a couple decades will argue this to be true. The USA is the most evil, unjust, and oppressive nation in the history of the world. This is all over higher education and in much of the politics today. Democracy and capitalism are oppressive and unjust and self-serving inventions of whiteness. Now, before I go on to this next one, I want you to understand, I believe that racism exists. I believe that racism is reprehensible. The problem is that we move the goalposts of what we consider to be racist so much that it makes the conversation almost meaningless. Math is racist. Reason and logic are racist. Valuing being on time is racist. The nuclear family is racist. If you disagree with my accusation of racism, then that is direct evidence of your racism. This is in a famous book that is in almost every corporation, major corporation, and school of higher learning. Almost everyone, this comes right out of that book. So what we call this is a Kafka trap, a logical fallacy. It's a sophistical rhetorical device in which any denial by the accused serves as evidence of guilt. So for those of you who took Shakespeare in high school, maybe in college, Julius Caesar, where Shakespeare writes, "Brutus, you dost protest too much." So it's kind of a Kafka trap. Now, there is a difference between a person who defensively denies their guilt and a person who rationally tries to argue why they are not guilty. In this scenario here, it doesn't matter. Just the fact that you deny implies you are guilty. So what happens then, because this sentiment, this assertion is so prevalent in the world today, that any denial on your part or my part, those people who hear that denial automatically assume you are guilty and you are what they said you are. You can't even get past that. They just automatically assume that's the truth about you. If we don't get a better handle on truth, then there is no way that we can convey to people in this world who God is and what He requires of us. And if we cannot convey that, then how can people be saved? If truth is not important to you, if you don't see truth as a primary reason for your existence, that truth lives in you, that you understand fully who God is as truth, and what He requires of us as truth. We have nothing to offer the world. I'll just come out and say it. I need some help. It can't be just people like me who try to engage people elsewhere in the world and get them to rethink the untruths and the fallacies of their lives. We can no longer assume that somehow this will just work itself out. If you don't treasure truth, if you don't treasure and value the process by which we attain it and the source from which it comes, then there's no fruit in our lives. So I'm going to say there are few more compelling and inspiring images than the person living with certainty of purpose and affect and truth while chaos swirls around them. All of the truths of our culture that I read to you, that's chaos. Those are lies from the pit of hell, from the liar himself. And we live in opposition to that. What I described to you is what we call the zeitgeist, the spirit of this age. And you and I, see, it used to be when we were growing up that you and I could lean on this Judeo-Christian worldview which had permeated this culture for almost 200 years. We could always defer to that. It no longer exists. And the only thing that we have left is this community or communities like this. Our own lives, our own experience, our own scriptures with which to combat it. We have to be that inspiring person. Even though people might consider us to be foolish. G.K. Chesterton said, "A man who has faith must be prepared not only to be a martyr, but to be a fool." There are people whom I have encountered who think that I threw my life away by being educated in the way that I've educated myself and by being in the profession that I do. In the zeitgeist of our age, the spirit of our age, if truth offends, then it cannot be truth. The truth that offends is always, they think, judgmental, ungracious, hateful, unloving, and unchristlike. And because of that, they think the only truths that are truly true and good are the ones that most affirm the inner perceptions of ourselves and our perception of any reality outside of ourselves. So if a person comes out and says they're transgender, if you choose, I mean, you can say nothing and they still feel disaffirmed. In their mind, because they came out and they said what they thought they were, you have to affirm them. Otherwise, you are being hateful. It used to be, if you said, "I think you're ridiculous for thinking that," that was considered to be hateful. Today, if you simply don't affirm, that's considered to be hateful. So, I just want to conclude with this passage from Isaiah 5, 18 through 22. "Woe to those who draw iniquity with the cord of falsehood, who draw sin as with a cart of ropes, who say, 'Let him be quick, let him speed his work that we may see it. Let the counsel of the Holy One of Israel draw near, and let it come that we may know it.' Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and shrewd in their own sight. This is the world. And you and I are called to stand in loving, faithful, obedient opposition to it. That we grow in the truth that God, of who Christ is and what he has called us to be and to do. We do that with confidence. We do that with love. We do that with certainty and surety. We do it because it's what it means to be faithful. It's what it means to love God. Even if the world considers you to be a fool, and even if they want to make you a martyr. I used to say, this little church on this big hill can make a great big difference in this little town. We still can. we still can, and we should, and we will. Will you help me? Will you help me be purveyors of truth, lovingly and obediently? People who are lost in darkness, they need to see that great light. And Jesus has opted that that light be you and me. That's who we are. And it's by that light that they see the dangers of the ground that they live on, and that they can navigate towards that light so they can embrace who God is and what He requires of them. So, if you get a chance, read Romans chapter 1. I was going to spend some time on that today, but I don't have time. Because what happens is this, that when people reject the truth long enough, God gives them over to their depraved minds. And that's a horrifying thing.